The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona, specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. There's 6 books in this series, and they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. Really interesting podcast today. I had Ted Trotta on. And Ted, you've probably seen Ted on TV. He does the Antiques Roadshow for the Native American material. He's been doing it for over 9 years. And a very good appraiser and dealer in early Native American art. And I got to find out what the business was like in the 70s and the 80s before I even got into it. I first got into it around the mid-80s, but Ted was way ahead of me. And he knew a lot of the real shakers and movers of that time frame, which some I knew and some I didn't. And he shared some of the stories. So I think you're really going to enjoy Ted Trotta. Wait, do I have a special guest today, Ted Trotta? And I say special because I've known Ted for 25 years, maybe longer. Yeah, we've shaken his head longer. And we've had drinks together, food together, bought things together, sold things, but we've never really sat down and talked about Ted. And that's what we're going to do. So welcome, Ted.
Mark, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Are you ready to go back to the growing up, and I assume in New York?
I did. I grew up in New York. I love being interrogated, by the way.
Yeah, but well, this isn't an interrogation. You'll know if it is when I really start probing.
No, I did. I grew up in New York on Long Island, a little town called Wantagh. Folks have been to the beach, maybe know Jones Beach. It's where I hung out. I had a fabulous childhood, terrific parents, and they introduced me to nature, and that has everything to do with why I'm here today.
Oh, that's interesting. And why do you say that? What does nature and Native American arts, tribal arts, have to do with, in your mind, with that?
It seemed nature, being in the cathedral of nature, if you will, seemed healthy. It seemed like a clean place, uncluttered, put me at peace. If I walked on the beach, I felt good. I began collecting rocks and sand glass at a young age. But I also I hung out in the woods. We had a nice home. There were big, old, overgrown apple trees. I lived in them. It's where I learned to read, where I learned to sit still so I could read, I suppose I could say. I didn't hang out on a ballpark or softball fields. I hung out in the woods, chased squirrels, looked at birds. Yep. And I probably wanted to be I hope this doesn't sound corny, a Native American as a child, and maybe I have aspects of that present to this day.
And read books about Native American history and that type of thing when you were a kid?
I think I read Bamba the Jungle Boy.
Yeah.
He chased panthers around the jungle. I'm not sure that I read books so much about Native Americans or the West. I know whenever it came down to cowboys and Indians, I was on, it was no question which side I was on.
Yeah.
I remain that way today.
Yeah. And it wasn't the Cowboys.
I beg your pardon?
And it wasn't the Cowboys.
Wasn't the Cowboys. Was not the Cowboys.
So what did your mom and dad do so that you really grew
up
there?
Well, my dad was a lawyer, and my mom was a homemaker. And my dad was my hero. He's a World War II veteran. I think I grew up wanting to be my dad, a strong man who saved innocent people.
What was his branch of service?
He retired as a lieutenant colonel.
Oh, so he did the, he retired through military.
He was a major probably during the war. And then by the time he left the service in the reserves, I suppose, he was a lieutenant colonel.
And what branch was that?
He was an army, specialized in anti-aircraft.
Uh-huh. And did you have to travel around a lot because of the military, or you were lucky to be kind of in one area and grow up in that area?
No, I came into their lives after the war. I was born in 1948.
Got it. Just made it under the baby boomer aspect.
I just made it. My sister, whose name was, she passed away, her name was Janice, but she was called Bonnie. My Bonnie lies over the ocean. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So we had a great family, one of five children. I was the second, the oldest boy. Uh-huh. And my dad loved nature, and my mother as well, but my father in particular loved nature. And that was my great inheritance. In addition to his, he was a fine man, and I honored and admired him. But we spent time in the Adirondacks and in the Catskills in northern, central northern New York State. Vacations were either at the beach or in the woods. I was in Cub Scouts, I was in Boy Scouts, I was a member of Order of the Arrow, I went into Explorers. When I got too old for all of that, I became an assistant scoutmaster. And so all of that has to do with a nature-oriented way of living.
And do you remember when you started collecting any type of thing, whether it was coins or comics or Native American material specifically?
I was sort of dyslexic as a child, and I was collecting coins because my grandfather did. And I kept pestering either my grandfather or my father to read to me how much such and such was worth and the history of it. And my grandfather finally said, if you want to become a sophisticated collector, son, you have to learn to read. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really until about third grade that I became a competent reader. I was behind in school up until that point.
You know, it's interesting, though, you know, when you have dyslexia and things like that, I think you visually do better and you learn to use your acuity and recognize things versus just learning how to read. And I find people that have had dyslexia are superior when it comes to recognizing objects. Do you think that may have helped you as well, as far as you, when you see a piece? So for instance, if you see a piece of Indian art that comes through your hands, do you remember it, even if you had it 10 years ago?
I have an emotional memory for everything I've ever encountered.
There you go.
I do not have a photographic memory, but if I liked it 25 years ago, I like it now.
You'll know immediately. Yeah,
yeah, and almost certainly, almost unquestionably, I'd like it more today. It's unfailing.
And don't you think that also helps you with price structure too, when you're trying to price these things? You can immediately remember, even if you don't know the amount it sold for or the amount you had it for, there's a general sense of the value?
Yes, in a sense. Yeah. Our business is a partnership. I work with Anna, my wife and partner, and we argue endlessly about value. And Anna will pose the question, well, who are you going to sell it to and for how much? And I'll say, well, I don't know, and I know I can get more. That's very clear to me. If I love the object and it's not an absurd valuation, I can resell it.
Yeah, you're more interested in trying to hang on to it and find the proper home. She might be a little bit more in the job of, let's get this sold because we need the money and we can get another thing.
Anna pays the bills.
There you go. Yeah.
Anna pays the bills.
I got it.
And she's very good at it. We have a great partnership. I like a lot of things. I'm a hunter and gatherer. Anna is more restrained. If the two of us happen to like an object, it's...
You're buying it.
We're in.
Yeah.
We're in.
Same with my wife.
Yeah.
It's a partnership.
It's amazing.
It makes a big difference.
It's a huge advantage. I mean, we drove out to Santa Fe just now. 3 or 4 days on the road, and we just, you know, we talk shop, we talk family, we argue, we bicker, and we work it out. It's a great advantage.
And did you stop and pick along the way just to see if you could find something that was in an antique mall? I know you did.
We did, in a sense, yes. We stopped and picked friends, actually. We drove from New York to Cincinnati, 3 different lovely engagements there. From there down to Arkansas, more friends, and then from Arkansas, we couldn't decide if we were going to go to Tulsa and the Philbrook and the Gilcrease or make it in on time, which we ended up doing. We had a nice drive. We love to drive.
And so I'll back you back up. So you started with your coins. Your grandfather says, okay, kid, if you want to learn about price structure, you better learn how to read. And you did. And so did your collecting go to coins, or did you soon go into something else?
I collected everything, actually. I mean, I collected coins. I would borrow $10 or $20 from my father in the morning, in the summers. I'd go to the local bank. I'd get rolls of nickels and dimes and pennies. I'd work my way through endless rolls of pennies and nickels and dimes.
I did the same thing, by the way.
I would go back to the bank that I had just cashed a $20 bill with like $19.50, and I'd get $19.50 worth of coins. Then an hour later, I'd go back with like $18. They'd hate me. But I filled up the books. It was great. It was great, and it was a discipline for me. It caused me to understand rarity, desirability, the difference between a Denver mark and a Philadelphia mark, or no mark at all.
Condition
was everything. I remember I tried to convince myself that I had a 1910 D Mercury dime. I'm not sure that I did. It had a lot of wear on it. But it was great, and I learned a bit about history in the process. I collected other things. I collected baseball cards, but I stuck them in the in my bicycle. What do you call them?
Yeah, the spokes.
I put them in the spokes so they'd make noise, and they're not worth too much today. Right.
But do you still have those?
Yeah, I do. I collect.
So John Malloy, who was here, and he's somebody you've known for a very long time. It sounds like since high school, since college, first freshman year in college. He just sold some of his cards this week that he collected as a kid for $1 each, and his grandkid for $2 each. So
Anna and I had the most lovely morning this morning. John came over with his daughter, Leah, and her two children, John's great-grandchildren, I guess, John Carlo and Katrina. And I heard all about their baseball cards.
Yes.
He made a killing.
Yeah. And by the way, when I wanted my coins, because I collected coins as well, I went to the lunch ladies who collected the money in junior high, because the kids would want to get something and they wouldn't have money, right? So we were kind of in a poorer area. So they would go through, I don't know where all they went through to get their money to buy their candies, but invariably I would find things that were 100 years old.
What was your favorite coin?
Well, I like the Benjamin half dollars. I thought those were fantastic.
Yeah, so you went big time. Yeah. I
always.
To me, it was the Buffalo nickel.
I would take anything, pennies, nickels, dimes.
Buffalo nickel, my favorite animal was the buffalo.
Well, you had like the Indian head penny then, right?
And flying eagle.
Oh, yeah.
Three or four years of flying eagles.
Yeah.
Then the Indian penny.
Yeah.
But the buffalo nickel had something
it
strong.
It does. Still does, actually.
Yeah. And it's a softer metal. They wear quickly. It's hard to find one in good condition.
So you collect the baseball cards.
Not really. I mean, that was because I didn't care about
and
baseball.
And when do you think you got your first piece of Native American art? Do you have any idea or recollection when that was?
I don't actually, but I can probably fill that in. I probably made bows and arrows myself.
I'm sure if you were in Boy Scouts.
I made stuff like that. But I was a school teacher. And for 5 years.
What school, what grades?
I beg your pardon?
What grades?
I taught at the college, at the University of Puerto Rico, and English literature. And then I taught at Kingsborough Community College in the city university system in New York. And I taught at an inner city high school in New York City, where Anna and I met. It was the start of a beautiful relationship. This was an inner city school just for troubled boys, and we loved it. It was great. It was in a school where the film Up the Down Staircase had been filmed.
I do know that film.
And there really was an up and a down staircase. And so I taught for 5 years in total. And then Adam
and what were those years that you were teaching? Do you remember?
Oh, man. 71, 72, 73, 74 maybe to 79.
But before that...
No, that's wrong. I beg your pardon. I graduated college in 71. I began teaching college immediately with a BA. And this was in the middle of Vietnam.
Yeah, talk about that, because you're in that group that got drafted, or in your case, it sounds like you probably went from high school right to college, so you got a deferment.
I had a college deferment. Then I had a very low draft number. So I was due to go.
Yeah. For those who out there who don't know what this means, they pulled the numbers of each day of the year. And if you got a low one, you went. And if you got a high one, you got a pass.
It was like a lottery.
It was a lottery. It was completely a lottery.
It was a lottery.
Exactly. I'm sure you remember vividly watching the TV when they pulled the numbers, don't you?
It was a challenging day.
Yes, right?
It was a challenging day. And I was very much against the war, I suppose. Muhammad Ali was a hero. Martin Luther King. And I couldn't see this war. It made no sense to me. And this is despite the fact that I felt that my father and others who had gone to World War II and to Europe and to the South Asia saved the world.
They did, actually.
I grew up wanting, in addition to being a hunter and gatherer, I wanted to be G.I. Joe as well. But times changed. I was in high school. I suddenly was confronted with the concept of my country right or wrong. And I wrestled with that. And I felt we were at a crossroads during Vietnam. It didn't make sense to me.
What did your dad think about that?
He struggled.
I bet.
He struggled mightily with it. Both my folks supported me. My dad wanted me to apply to West Point, which I did. So I was struggling with going to West Point, and I had Congress people in my county representing me. And I had Bob Dylan and Muhammad Ali and Martin Luther King on the other side. And so I applied for I went to quite a few marches against the war in Washington. I was a march marshal, and I was active politically in college.
This is kind of late, 67, 68, 69 kind of time?
I graduated high school in 67.
Yeah.
I had just been on a track meet with a kid a year older than me. He went to Vietnam, was dead a month later. Hmm. That kind of focused my attention. I went to a liberal college in New York City, Fordham University, same college where John Malloy went. Mm-hmm. It was a Jesuit institution, a Catholic college, they called it, with a small C. Mm-hmm. It was quite liberal, rigorous standards, however, and intellectual honesty was important. And I got involved in a lot of things in the 60s that were fun and distracting and illuminating. And by the time I graduated, I had to make a decision. I was either going to jail or Vietnam, and Canada wasn't an option. So I applied for a conscientious objector status. I had a Jesuit mentor, professor, who also happened to be a military chaplain. Hmm. And he was very fond of me, and he completely disagreed with my position, but he knew it was in earnest. He wrote a letter on my behalf. My folks did as well, some other folks, supportive people. And I got this conscientious objector status, which was purely because I had the opportunity to defend my position. It was not an easy classification to get.
Not at all. And was this about 70 or 71?
71.
Yeah.
1971. So I had performed 2 years alternative service, and I got a teaching position at the University of Puerto Rico up in the Central Mountains, a college called the Colegio de Calle, fabulous place. And so I taught there for 2 years. Then I came back to New York City. I got a job as a adjunct lecturer at a community college in the city at night. I was teaching at an inner city high school during the day, and I was going to graduate school every other night. So I was teaching in Brooklyn at night. I was teaching in Manhattan during the day, and I was going to graduate school in the Bronx 2 or 3 nights a week.
And what was the graduate school? What was your subject?
Lehman College.
And what were you majoring in? What was your
English literature?
In English literature. Yeah.
Shakespeare, Milton, John Donne. That was my deal.
Yeah.
But after about 5 years, I wasn't going on to a doctoral degree. I kind of understood that, and. And I think I was a little bit wrung out, perhaps.
Had you gotten married?
No. But Anna and I were together, and she was going out to Ann Arbor, Michigan to pursue she's got 3 masters, and she was going out to work on one of them. And I didn't want her going out alone.
Yeah.
So I followed her out. I had, on my dad's behalf, begun a little antique business for him, which was a terrible disaster. Didn't work at all.
So your dad was saying, son, you need a job?
He was changing himself, and he was a lawyer. He'd worked in real estate and banking. His circumstances changed. I said, well, Dad, get away from that. You always wanted to be around objects you love. He wanted to be a gardener, landscaper, things like that. His father convinced him to be a lawyer. His father was Fiorello LaGuardia's tax commissioner in New York City. Oh. And he said, son, become a lawyer. You'll never regret it. So my father regretted it. At any rate, long story short, we started a little antique business.
You and your father?
Yeah. And it was a disaster.
And where was this located? You did this? Where, what city?
We bought out the contents of an existing antique shop in the Bronx. And we opened up a little antique shop, I guess you could call it. It was not particularly sophisticated, in Westchester County, where they lived. And it turns out that little shop that we bought was managed by a man who was an antique repairman. And virtually everything we bought was damaged.
And repaired, and you didn't know it when you bought it.
We didn't know. I was pretty naive. And I had just spent a chunk of my parents' money on this antique shop that was a repair shop.
And this was a lot of furniture and things like that, country, antiques? And
no, not country, more urban things, but paintings, ceramics, silver.
American, though, primarily?
Yes. No, American and European.
Yeah. Okay.
This was in the Bronx, a lot of immigrants in the Bronx. So it was interesting. You can learn a lot studying broken objects.
You can, that's true. And the backs of objects as well.
Absolutely. So I got them out of their investment.
How long did that last? How long were you in the antiques business?
A year and a half, maybe, with my folks. And I got them out. Made them whole, as we say in the business. But then there were some leftover objects. And I was, at that point, then going to follow Anna out to Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I had $250. Anna's dad, at this point, had given us a work van. He was a fish wholesaler in the city. And he gave us his old van, which happened to smell of fish.
Yeah, I'm sure it did, and lots of scales, too.
Lots of scales. So I filled up his van with the detritus from this little antique business that we had managed to get through. And I had $250, actually. And we drove out to Ann Arbor, and the Midwest was just rife with, there was antiques everywhere, collectibles everywhere.
What time of year was that? Was that early 80s?
1976, I think. 77.
Yeah, so. Okay.
I'm terrible when you ask me these.
Yeah, that's okay.
So at any rate, you asked me what the first Indian object I'd ever bought.
Correct.
So there was a trade paper out there called the Tri-State Trader, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. And it came out, I think, like every week. And there would be page after page of antique shows, flea markets, auctions, different venues. And you could pick and choose. And I would go Michigan, Indiana, Ohio. And one day I saw a small advertisement for a man's estate sale. And it said the estate sale of a gentleman named Clyde Anderson, a farmer probably or something, in St. John's, Michigan. And I decided, well, I'm going to go to that. I said, I had never bought a Native American object. I said to Anna, I can't believe this. They're selling Indian stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I got in the car about 3 a.m. in the morning. I drove to St. John's, Michigan, fully believing I was going to cream this auction. I came from New York. I had $250.
And you were there early.
And I was there early. Very early, and I had to park about a quarter of a mile from the Grange Hall where the auction was being held. There were so many people there. It was a humiliating moment. So I hiked in, and I suddenly realized I had no idea what I was doing. And there was a lady behind the display counter. I said, oh, are you familiar with this material? She said, yes, it was my dad's collection.
Yep, so she knew it.
So I said, oh. I said, what would your dad tell a young fellow who's looking to get into this business? What would he advise? So she said, I was smart enough to ask questions.
That's a very good question, by the way.
So she said, well, my dad loved this blackware pottery by this lady named Maria. I said, oh. So she told me about it. It had no impact on me. It looked brand new. And it was.
And you didn't know who Maria Martinez was at this point?
I didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, he liked beadwork, too. And she showed me like a Sioux beaded vest or something. It was glass beads. They were shiny. It looked new. Didn't resonate. And then she said, well, he also collected artifacts. I said, oh. And there were thousands of stone pre-contact axes, mauls, pestles, celts.
And now that stuff looks old.
It looked old. And I had used to walk along the beach, pick up stones, so I knew a good stone from a bad one. And all of that, it all looked obviously authentic. And there were crates, hundreds of crates of stone artifacts, orange crates, fruit baskets, etc. The auction started. They held up a crate of, first of all, they held up a blackware pot. Maria went from, you know, hundreds of dollars, triple what I had in my pocket. They held up the beaded vest. It went for a chunk of money. Then they held up a crate of stone artifacts. And the auctioneer was trying to get $12, $15. And he got 15, 15, 18, 18, 18, 20, 20. And I raised my paddle. I got the box of like 12, 15 prehistoric, authentic stone axes.
Yeah.
This is a country auction. They brought the box to me, put it down in front of me. Another box, $15. Another box, $20. Within about a half an hour, you could not see me. I was covered with boxes of stone artifacts. I bought hundreds of them at $15 or $20 a clip. Then the auctioneer picked up one axe, he held it aloft, and it sold for $450. And I was stricken. I said, I've just bought 200 of them for $200 or something.
And they just
sold one.
And you didn't equate the fact that that might have been the great piece and yours were not anywhere close to it.
I did equate on the moment.
Oh, you did? Good.
Yeah, I was freaked out. So I tapped on the shoulder of the man in front of me, who was one of the underbidders. I said, excuse me, sir. I was whispering. I said, what just happened? I said, I've just bought 100 of these for $20 a box, and one just sold for $450. He said, oh. He said, that was a rare Michigan barbed axe. I said, oh, I see. Fast forward a little bit. I had no reputation. I couldn't get into an antique show in Ann Arbor. There was a famous, a lot of people in our business know it, Ann Arbor Saline Road Antique Fair, a couple of times a summer. Very great show. But I couldn't get in. So I went to Ypsilanti, Michigan, which is a very impoverished town where the Ford Motor Company had a parts division or something. Impoverished. And I got a table at a flea market on a Wednesday night in the poorest town in America for $8 a table. And I put some of my broken wares out from the antique
business. Right, your rocks. Yeah.
Then I had a box of these rocks under my table. 6 o'clock, the show opened. I reached down. I put one of the stone axes on the table. Within 2 minutes, there was a man queued up to, how much is the axe? I had no idea. I said, $15. Boom. He bought it. He left. I reached under the table. I put another axe on the table. You know the story.
Supply and demand.
Another guy came right up. Different individual. These farmers and country people, they knew what they were doing. They grew up with this material.
So yeah, they were plowed up in their fields,
yes,
quite frankly.
Themselves, their dad, their grandfather. So the second man said, how much? I go, $20. Boom, he buys it. And I said, this is going to work. Anna, in the meantime, I had laid all of these hundreds of axes on the floor of this Victorian home we were renting the second floor in, and she's typing a philosophy paper. And I laid them all out right after the auction. I'm backing up a week. I was so proud of myself. I had all these stones. I knocked on the door. I said, honey, take a look at this. She opened the door. Rocks! Slammed the door. I could hear her typing on this is pre-electric typewriter. She's pounding away the paper twice as fast.
All right.
And this, by the way, was all the money I had in the world.
Yeah.
So now fast forward, I did the flea market. I sold two of them, one for $15, one for $20. I knew I was going to become a millionaire soon. And it went on like this. The following week, I showed a lady an artifact that was in the box, but I didn't know what it was. It was beautiful, though. It was an elliptical stone. And she said, how much? I said, madam, this came in with a box of Indian stones, prehistoric. I said, but I don't know what this is. It was elegant, though. So she said, well, how much? I said, $45. She said, oh, okay. She left. week later, Wednesday night, 6 o'clock, she was right at my table, my $8 table. And she said, I was here last week. Do you still have that stone object? I said, I do. She said, well, I'd like to buy it. I said, well, do you remember I told you I don't know what it is? I said, it might be a stone artifact. I said, it could also be a sharpening stone for a scythe. She said, oh, well, may I see it? I showed it to her. She said, well, how much is it? I said, the same price I told you last week, $45. She had money crumbled up in her hand. She handed it to me.
Yeah, she had done her research.
And I said, oh, okay. I said, I hope you're comfortable with it. She said, I'm getting it from my husband. I said, well, I hope it's what you want it to be. She reached into her purse, took out a book, opened the book to a photograph of what appeared to be this object. And she went, ha, ha, ha. Not nice.
Yeah, not nice.
I was a little stricken. I didn't understand. And she walked away. And she stuffed the artifact deep in her purse and just took off. I said, madam, come back, come back. I said, may I see that book? So she took the book out of her purse. I wrote down the name. It was Lar Hotham's Stone Artifact Guide or something like that. I said, thank you very much. I gave her back the book. She took off. And then I bought every book that came across my path that had anything to do with Native American anything.
You learned a very valuable lesson.
Instantaneously. Yeah. And I was very fortunate, I had this academic background. And I took the vocabulary of scholarship, in my case, English literature, and I just changed the verbs and the nouns. So instead of Shakespeare or Milton, you know, it was Iroquois or Sioux. Instead of, you know, parchment and ink, it was stone, leather, hide. So I had the template to learn this quickly. And I was fortunate that I did. And I had a lot of people help me. Everybody I asked a question of who knew more than I answered generously. I had so many people help me. It was extraordinary.
And who would have been one of those people? Do you remember some of the traders that helped you along the way?
You probably know Bill Spencer. He's a Michigan dealer, has a company called The Rag Man.
Yeah, yeah.
He was in Albuquerque this weekend. He's a living encyclopedia. I was at a market. I bought something, which I thought was a Native American tomahawk, and it had the word tote, T-O-T-E, engraved or stamped on it. And I bought it. It probably wasn't particularly expensive or something. And I wanted it to be a Native American tomahawk. I was a wannabe.
Yeah.
And I bumped into him. I already was aware of his sophistication. And I said, Bill, I didn't know him particularly well. I said, excuse me, you know, he was running around. I was running around. I said, do you have a minute? Could you look at something? And I showed him. He said, oh, yes, that's very nice. He said, that's from the Fraternal Order of Red Men. I said, oh, really? I said, is that a Native tribe? He said, no, it's the folks who took on a Native motif as their fraternal regalia. And that word tote means, in Pennsylvania Dutch or something, death, or something along those lines.
And you felt that right at that moment, I'm sure.
So I learned
death of a dream.
I learned all about what I didn't want.
Yeah.
And he was great. He was so generous. And that wasn't the last time he helped me. I finally got into this Ann Arbor Saline Road antique show.
And what year would it be? So that was 76 when you first started doing the other stuff. So did it take a couple of years to get into it?
We were in Michigan for 2 years. No. And my learning curve moved rapidly, and the transformation from broken antiques to Native American art and folk art, American folk art as well, and vintage photography. I was still not quite focused. But I had a couple of early Catlinite pipes, and Anna was working with me. We set a booth up at this antique show. We had an outdoor space, and we set the booth up, and I took off wanting to be a hunter and gatherer.
Yeah, you were looking for more things.
Things. And I came back to the table, and Anna said, oh, I just sold the two Catlinite pipes. I said, oh, wonderful. I said, do you know who you sold them to? She said, two young men, they have a museum in Flint, Michigan. I said, oh, really, what are their names? She said, Dick Port and his brother, Tom. I didn't know them from Adam. I said, oh, one thing led to another. I ended up meeting Dick. He introduced me to Jim Ritchie, a well-known collector from the Midwest, now deceased. And it became like a fraternity of people with shared interests.
Right, and Dick Portwood became a very major collector in Plains artifacts, and he did books on his collection.
His dad was a legend.
Yeah.
Dick Sr. was a legend.
Yep.
And Dick was in his dad's footsteps.
Yes. And still does.
Oh, yeah, he's the gold standard.
Yeah, at one point he was one of the owners of Morningstar, right?
Correct.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely.
And a very nice man, too.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Deep knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely dependable and generous to this day.
And how old was he? He would have been close to your age, maybe a little younger even at that point?
We're probably roughly contemporaries.
Yeah.
I'm probably a little grayer than he is.
Yeah.
Roughly.
So Dick helped buy things for you, and you started to make inroads into the Native American collector milieu of people at that point.
We did. We left Ann Arbor, Michigan, went back to New York City. Pardon me. Anna went to Barnard College at Columbia, and she had a lot of lady friends still in the city, and we managed to get a really fabulous apartment overlooking Morningstar Drive, overlooking the Hudson River on Morningstar Drive. That's way uptown in Manhattan, 157th Street. Happened to have been across the street from the High Foundation.
Ah.
And so I was going into the High Foundation, not daily, but weekly, where there were a million objects.
Yeah, Native American object. And did you know it was there when you got the apartment, or was that just coincidence?
I probably was vaguely aware of it. It was called the Audubon Center, and the American Numismatic Association was also housed there, the Hispanic Society, and this legendary High Foundation collection. But we needed a venue to sell our wares. So I was able to get into a flea market on Canal Street in Lower Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Right, for folks who know Manhattan, it was the southern border of Soho, right between West Broadway and Wooster. This is 40 years ago. So this is when Soho was still an affordable enclave for artists.
Yes, it was. It was mainly artists and musicians at that point in time.
Exactly. So I got my booth in the flea market on the third floor. It's very hard to get people to go to the second floor.
And you have to carry those rocks upstairs.
Yes, we did. So I got on the third floor, and the manager of the flea market took a shine to us, and he started sending his clients up. Again, another instance of generosity from our colleagues over and over again. Eventually, I got a spot on the second floor, then on the first floor, then I opened up a little shop in a used electronics store right next to the flea market. And at this point, I had a few Navajo textiles. You'll relate to this. I had a transitional banded blanket, and in walked Tony Berlant.
Right.
At this point, I had, since I had been on this urgent need to own every book published, I had Walkin' Beauty.
Okay.
And I was learning about Navajo blankets, and I had more of an interest in blankets than rugs. And Tony walked in, and I didn't know him. And he said, oh my goodness, he said, I'm trying to get away from this. He said, I want to do my own thing. I'm trying to get away from
trying to make his own
blankets.
Art.
What are you doing here? So he was very sweet and gracious. And I said, I don't understand this Bayeda thing. He said, oh, it's easy. I said, it's not easy. So he said, well, the body of the blanket's going to be made out of hand spun, and it's woven a particular way. And the ravel joints are different, particularly if you have microscopic eyes. So I said, I'm not seeing it. He said, close your eyes. I said, I beg your pardon? He said, close your eyes. He said, run your hand over this section that's hand spun. And when your fingers suddenly close tighter on the yarn, he said, something's happened. You've gone from one yarn to another. And in this case, you've gone from hand spun to a raveled yarn. I said, oh, and I opened my eyes at that point.
And that also means more money, too, if it means earlier, and earlier generally means a higher value. So he just gave you an incredible gift.
He gave me the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah.
The keys to the kingdom.
And for those people who don't know who Tony Berlant is, he is a Native American expert in textiles for sure, and was one of the earliest guys buying and selling. He would buy these and sell them to the modernists and a lot of the very early New York artists like Warhol and Donald Judd and those individuals. And he's a fantastic artist unto his own right.
Absolutely. And with an extraordinary aesthetic.
Extraordinary, I agree.
He would look at a banded blanket and see mesas on the horizon, or he would he'd compare a grid to a Mondrian painting.
Yeah, he was probably one of the first, if not the first person, to see them for their art sake and where the modernism was coming from more than anyone else.
I think so.
And his daughter is an incredible actress, by the way.
I'm sorry.
His daughter is an incredible actress as well. She's a comedian and actress, too.
Yes.
Just saw her in a movie. She's fantastic.
Yeah. I remember Tony and his wife strolling her in a little four-wheel stroller down Canal Street, and he would buy metallic objects that he would incorporate into his artwork, and Soho was just throbbing with artistic energy. Fast forward a little bit, we just had our first son, Teddy, and his brother James, but Ted was born, and we decided we needed a home with a backyard and grass. So we left our, at this point, successful little shop on Canal Street, and we bought a home in Dutchess County, about 2 hours north of Manhattan. And I just thought, well, it's the business is booming, you know, relative to our finances, which were modest. And I just, well, this will continue. You know, we got enough money for a down payment for a house. We'll just keep it going. And I got a little booth in an antique mall in a very Tony town called Millbrook, New York. It's a horse town, loaded and tasteful. And I just thought, I'll do what I did on Canal Street and even better. And I got a booth in this antique mall for $90 a month, and I couldn't make booth rent. I couldn't sell $90 a month.
And why is that? Was it the clientele, or were you not getting the material that you were getting in New York City because there's so many more people and so many more ways to find material? Something was different, because you're the same.
Urban areas are exciting. There's a brain trust, there's energy, people buy things, they do their apartments, they're exciting. Country people seem more settled in, perhaps more conservative. I'll probably get in trouble for saying that, but there's something different about selling in an urban center as opposed to in this case it was a pastoral horse countryside. It was a glorious area. It just wasn't working. I'm sure other people were doing just fine. I wasn't.
So it was either something, maybe the material was not resonating possibly, or maybe it was just the wrong place.
It probably all still smelled of fish.
Yeah.
So we were in trouble. We had a beautiful set of wicker furniture on our little farmhouse, and we had to sell it to pay the mortgage. And we had a new baby. And I said to Anna, I said, I don't know. I said, I think I have to go back to Manhattan. That's where our business had developed. So I packed up the fish van, and I got up at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I drove into Manhattan to a flea market called The Annex on West 26th Street. And I got a couple of tables for probably not very much, 50 bucks or something, 100 bucks. And I put our wares out, and within about a half an hour, I had $1,500 in my pocket. I couldn't believe it. And this was prior to cell phones. So I got someone to watch the table. I walked over to a payphone. I called up Anna. I said, we're going to be okay. I said, as long as I'm willing to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
And come down to New York, I can make a rent.
Andy Warhol, the following week, bought a Navajo bracelet from us.
What was that like? Yeah. Did he buy it directly from you?
Yeah. And he had a guy standing behind him with a Polaroid camera, memorialized the whole thing.
He did?
He was lovely, totally gracious.
Did he ask for a discount?
I probably offered it before he asked.
And you knew who he was.
Yeah.
You recognized him?
Yeah. He had a white wig on.
Yeah. He was Andy after
all.
It was Andy. And was so, when you made contact with that individual and he's buying a bracelet, were you able to capture him as a client, or was it just a kind of one-off?
It was a one-off, but New York City was exciting. You'd never know who you were going to encounter.
And by the way, for those out there, Andy did collect that kind of material. He had lots of rugs and blankets and Indian material. He got it and loved it.
Years later, after he passed, I got into a warehouse, the Andy Warhol warehouse. Don Ellis and I got in, and we bought a Chilcat blanket. We bought a Haida template for weaving Chilcat blankets. So I'm forgetting the name of the object. They're very rare. But that's fast forwarding. Alex Acevedo, the art dealer on Madison Avenue, his specialty was Hudson River School of Painting. But he was also buying anything that excited him. Mickey Mouse collectibles, expensive 19th century toys, mechanical banks, Asian Netskis, samurai swords, but he was buying Native American material. He would go to an auction. As a matter of fact, I went to an auction in Maine, and there was a great, great, great collection. There was a Ghost Dance shirt, there was a painted war shirt and leggings, a great club, and a lot of our colleagues were there. Eleanor Hancock, now passed. Bob Ashton, also gone. Jimmy Hart. There's a whole cluster of people. Marty Ellman, Jeff Myers, old partner. And this Native American collection came up, and nobody bid on it. Everybody sat on their hands except this one guy in a flannel shirt, a baseball cap in the back of the auction, and he just held his paddle up.
The painting dealer.
I didn't know who he was. And I kept bidding against him with no money. And he kept buying everything. And I finally leaned over to this gentleman, Marty Ellman, who's a really nice guy. I said, "Marty, what's going on?" I said, "All you guys, everybody I know with more experience and money than I, you're not buying these treasures." Marty leaned forward. He said, "Ted, you should do your homework before the auction starts." I didn't know what he meant exactly.
Yeah.
Alex paid everybody off not to bid against him.
You ringed it.
Everybody.
Wow.
So I went up to him when he was paying for his goods. These are masterpieces.
Yeah.
The shirt and leggings, it's a million-dollar property today. So I went up to him, I said, "Excuse me, sir." I said, "I apologize. It seems like I was the only guy bidding against me."
Legally bidding.
So he said, "Don't apologize." He said, "Here's my card. Come see me on Monday." I said, "I'll do it." So he had a gallery on Madison Avenue. I drove home. I went to see him that Monday, and he said, "I'm buying Native American art." He said, "You bring it to me." And that changed everything. I would sell to him every 2 weeks. I'd go out in the countryside, I'd find something, I'd bring it to him. I'd have to wait because people queued up to see him. And I would wait and I would wait, and he'd finally see me. And, "What do you got? Blah, blah, blah." He'd always cut the fat off a deal. No matter what the price was, he'd take it down 10% and then buy it. And that became the foundation for the Splendid Heritage Masco collection. And then I met George Terasaki, the legendary collector dealer. He was known not to talk, so I had an appointment to see him. I tried to start at the top if I could when I was starting. So I made an appointment to see him. He was always the inside front cover of American Indian Art magazine.
Right.
Great, great things.
Again, this is kind of early 80s.
Yes, yes, 81, 80, yeah, I think yeah. So, 81-ish. So I made an appointment to see him. He said, "Fine, come down." Anna and I were late, couldn't get a parking place. Anna had to stay in the car. I ran up, I was with him for an hour. I came down, Anna said, "How did it go?" I said, "It was great." She said, "What did you talk about?" I said, "He didn't say a word." I said, "You're up there for an hour." I said, "He didn't say one word." He had second phase blankets hanging on the wall. He had primarily Northwest Coast material. And I went around and I just kept peppering him with questions, and he just sort of nodded and nodded, and he didn't say anything. And then over time, we became fast friends, and he became my guru. So I was selling to Alex. I was learning from George. There were a few other people, Bill Guthman, Guthman Americana, Connecticut dealer, also passed. George is gone now, too.
Right.
But I was attracted to these older folks.
And where do you think he got his knowledge? Where did George, he obviously clearly had an eye, because he had...
George was Japanese-American. His family was incarcerated or retained on a...
Internment camp.
An internment camp in Arizona. George is around 12 years old. He loved it. He was in scouting. He had a great time there. He was bitter about it later, but while it was going on, he enjoyed it.
Yeah, he didn't know better. I've heard that from other kids. They just didn't know. I mean, for the parents and everyone else, it was a nightmare.
But eventually that was over, and his family was, his folks must have been amazing. His brother became a renowned surgeon in L.A. He had another brother who was a great engineer. His brother in L.A. invented a heart valve. You relate to this. Every heart operation in the world utilized one of Paul Terasaki's heart elements. He became extremely wealthy.
I'm sure.
And very renowned. He gave $50 million to the L.A. medical community. $50 million.
Yeah.
When $1 million was $1 million.
Yeah.
And George became this amazing collector, legendary. And he had a Geiger counter. He would look at an object, and if it wasn't a 9 or a 10, it didn't hit his register. And I would offer him objects, and he wouldn't put his hands up to touch them. And that told me it wasn't registering.
Yeah.
And if I showed him an object that he touched, I knew it was great. And so I began to...
And was price secondary to him?
I beg your pardon?
Was price secondary to him?
He didn't pay attention to the price.
Yeah, it all had to do with the quality and
just
what it was.
Did he want it?
And somehow he had enough money that he could bankroll and do this kind of stuff?
He was, there were not too many people doing what we're doing today in his moment. So he was...
He was selling to the wealthy of the wealthy, the best objects, so he was able to always have capital, basically?
Yes. Yes, and he worked hard.
I'm sure.
Do you remember the Claylin brothers in Scottsdale?
I've heard the name.
He was buying very fine historic pottery from them, Mimbres pottery as well. He got into a big basketry collection in California. He had a small little car. He filled it to the roof with baskets. He drove to the Glenbow Museum in Canada, sold all the baskets, drove back to the collection in California, filled the car up to the roof, drove back to the Glenbow. He just kept doing this over and over again. This is when objects were being sold for under $100.
Right.
And he was not bashful, so he probably sold them for $200. But he did well, and he created maybe the finest Northwest Coast Eskimo collection of its day. I'm jumping all over now, but Eugene Thor, the art dealer,
right,
who created the remarkable collection in Cooperstown, New York,
The Thaw Collection.
He wanted... George had lent a lot of his objects to Native American Heritage, the book that... Senior moment. The Native American Heritage. It followed Sacred Circles, a legendary collection. And George had a lot of objects in it, and Gene Thor wanted those objects. He knew how to track down masterpieces.
And Gene, for those who didn't know, it had lots of money and collected many other things besides that, including Impressionists and modern art. And
Gene was the most successful fine art dealer in the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah, he had great stuff.
He was selling to Japanese pension companies, French Impressionist paintings.
And he loved Native American art.
He recognized an enormous opportunity there. His wife, Claire, liked objects with flags, and they began a little fledgling collection of pillows and vests and things with flags. And Gene recognized that this was our national heritage, and there was an opportunity here. And he had the wherewithal and the vast experience of a great dealer to seize the moment. And he wanted what George Terasaki had. But so Gene was the greatest fine art dealer in America. George was the greatest Native American collector dealer in America, and they were like oil and vinegar. Both stubborn. And Gene approached me one day. He said, I understand you're friends with George. Could you intervene? I need a facilitator. I said, I can't. He's so stubborn, I can't do a deal. I said, nothing would please me more.
I'm sure.
And we did a deal. We did it. I got Gene to go to George's warehouse on the west side of Manhattan, and we rehearsed how we would proceed. And Gene kept saying, his prices are, they're not even visionary, they're obscene, you know, and I can't do this. I said, well, listen, we know the numbers in advance, and they are strong. I said, let's go to the most expensive item on the list. It's a Tlingit Raven Rattle, Northwest Coast, a world-class masterpiece. And it was costly. And I said, Gene, we'll ask George what the price is, and he'll tell us. And I said, just say yes. Oh, I can't do that. I've got to. I said, Gene, just say yes. He's a little bit of a curmudgeon. And he said, okay. I said, then we'll proceed. I said, George has a goal in mind. We have to reach a certain critical mass, or he doesn't want to sell anything. I said, so let's just take it step by step. So Gene said yes. And George just sat in his chair, relaxed. He got immediately friendly, calm, warm, and fuzzy. We went to the next object, and Gene said, well, I'd like to buy such and such. And George says, well, I want so and so. And I said, George, Gene would like to get this. Can you give him a little room? Well, okay. And he came down like whatever, 5 or 10%. And we went like this, and we got to about 18 or 19 objects with a gigantic number. and Gene finally said, stop, I can't do any more. And George said, I can't let anything else go. And everybody shook hands. And that was the foundation of Gene's, a significant foundation of Gene's collection in Cooperstown. He also got Jerry Peters' textile collection. You know, he was amazing. He was omnivorous.
What was that like? You're in there watching this go down with two of the biggest collectors in America and dealers, and you're the middleman kind of facilitating. What was that like?
Otherworldly.
Yeah, it must be, right?
I was so flattered and grateful for this opportunity. I couldn't believe it. And there were levels of trust, of course, being extended around. Everybody was very gracious, and I got a big, big check as the facilitator.
Yes.
And I left the meeting, and I got in my car, and I drove 4 hours to Brimfield, Massachusetts to go flea marketing. And I got up there. Anna was with our sons. My mom and dad were watching them when we would go around Brimfield picking. And I walked in and I laid a check on the table, and everybody was aghast. Huh? And then I went to bed, and we got up like 3 hours later, and we went out picking the fields.
Went back to work. You went with two of the most important movers and shakers in this field in the world. And then the next morning, you're out at a swap meet, basically.
Yes.
Walking the fields, looking for objects.
I wasn't walking the fields.
Running.
I was running.
Yeah. Those are the days you could run. Those days are over. Now you're walking. And some of us are in wheelchairs.
You're exactly correct. So it's been this amazing journey. And it's been a journey that, you know this so well, Mark, this is not average material. It can be modest, but it's not average. These are animistic inspired objects. Everything has a soul. The native cosmology is spiritual to its core. Every object's made not as a decorative object, but as a fundamentally curative object, whether it's clothing embellished with sacred imagery, whether it's a textile with rain imagery or lightning bolts. Everything has to do with rain.
Yeah, and I think that not only if it's, you know, even if it was made for the trade and or for sale for the tourist, you still have that being in it. It's still there. And I think people have to recognize that too.
They do have to recognize that. And there are ways of apprehending that. There are pre-reservation days when everything is deeply imbued with meaning. There is a transitional period where those meanings linger. And as you say, when objects are being specifically made for the trade, that changes somewhat, not entirely. I had it explained to me once by the anthropologist, Ted Carpenter. He said, imagery is a little bit like a missile that takes off from the launching pad and it gains velocity as it travels. And then as the fuel expires, the missile continues. And that's what the impetus for this sacred imagery. In an early day, pre-contact day, pre-Christopher Columbus, the religion develops. And it reaches a great level of potency early with Western contact, trade materials, exotic yarns, trade colors, glass beads, and as an efflorescence, if you will, as a peak moment. And then post-Civil War, things change dramatically. And in the Southeast, the Trail of Tears, 1837 or something, there's crushing hardship. This is the sad part of the story. You've got Manifest Destiny clearing its path from the east across the plains, from the southwest up, from Russia and Alaska down, and the native people tend to get crushed. And then it becomes an epic story of survival and adaptation.
The long walk for the Navajos in 1864 to 1868.
A very long walk. You go from Kit Carson and Canyon de Chelly to Bosque Redondo. Mm-hmm. They kill all of the fine churro sheep. They destroy the economy of these people.
Yep.
Then they have to feed them. Then they give them a new breed of sheep so they don't have to keep feeding them. And they're merino sheep. It's not quite as soft and fine as the earlier things. This is your area, but the traders convince the ladies to sell them weavings. They weigh them by the pound and pay them by the pound. The ladies leave a little lanolin and dirt in the weavings because they're not foolish.
Yep.
Suddenly the traders realize we're killing the golden goose here. They convince the ladies to clean the wool a little better, weave it a little finer, more like a blanket.
Or the ladies convince them to pay what they should.
Yeah. And we'll pay you more.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there's this amazing Navajo revival of these glorious rugs, of which, they're world-renowned textiles.
And one of the things, because we're kind of running out of time, and I want to get just into one little area, because I think it's interesting. So you've been doing the Antiques Roadshow now as an appraiser for how many years? I don't even know. It seems like a lot.
I'm still a newbie, they call me, but I think 9 years.
9 years as a newbie. What's that like doing that? I mean, I know I do it on my own when people walk in the door and I can tell just by the way they're handling the object if they don't even have a clue. And I usually sit them down and said, you're going to have a little moment here. Please sit down. We'll put the object down on the table. But what's it been like to work as an appraiser on the roadshow for 9 years?
Well, I'm less anxious now than I was when I began.
I'm sure. Yeah, I noticed these cameras and mics don't bother you in the least.
But when I started, I perspire, and I would be under the lights and the cameras and anxious, and I would perspire. But the technicians are great. They cut out all the sweat and drips. But it's
we don't, by the way.
You know, I like people very much, and I like objects. So it's a nice combination. And people line up. Like 6 o'clock in the morning in the earlier days. Now they get timed passes. But in the early days, they would come with their objects on, get online, like 6 o'clock in the morning. Pardon me. And they would wait sometimes an hour, 2 hours, to have their moment, their sometimes 2 minutes with the appraiser. And the appraisers, there are 70 of us, generally speaking, on a given episode. It's a remarkable mind. It's a remarkable brain trust, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of talent.
Yes.
An enormous amount of talent. And if you don't know something, you talk to your colleagues. There's a lot of collaboration. They used to get 6,000 or 7,000 guests a day with two objects apiece. And you would just sit there and keep praying that someone's going to bring you a treasure.
Right.
Or a very good human interest story. And if you happen to get a good human interest story with a treasure, all the better. And the producers need a certain number of clips to fill their film can, I guess they call it. And if they're not successful, they'll come and whisper in your ear toward the end of the day. They'll say, make lemonade out of lemons. But the people are invariably nice. Everyone is nice. Everybody wants their moment. They're excited. They've seen the show themselves. Yes. They hope they have a treasure. You're not supposed to betray, as you know, any enthusiasm. If you think the object is something that they might want to pitch on TV, you have to stay completely poker-faced.
Yeah. That can be hard, I'm sure, at some times.
Oh, my God.
When you have some magnificent treasure in front of you that you get more than anybody, maybe in the entire world, it's sitting in front of you. You know what it is. You know the value. And you can clearly look at this person's face and know they'd have no clue. And you have to somehow play dumb.
You have to keep your temples from throbbing. And the people are nice. So you say, you know, this is interesting. Maybe the producers would like to take a look at it. And then you situate them in a spot and you ask them to cover it up so nobody spills the beans. Then they send you off to what they call the green room for pancake makeup.
Yeah.
That was an interesting experience for me the first time. And then, you know, you ask some leading questions. You hope that they haven't really... that they don't know too much. You know, you'd like to know, where did they get it? Did you buy it? How much did you pay for it? But you don't want them to know everything because you want to try and tell them something.
Right.
And then you deliver a number, and you're supposed to bite your tongue and let them react and emote. And then, you know, a follow-up question, and sometimes it works great and sometimes it falls completely flat.
Yeah, because they know, or they thought it was even worth more.
Yes, yes, precisely. Precisely. The appraisers have no idea what they're going to see. So they're
it's a crapshoot.
They're just as surprised as the guest. You know, people line up and they just keep coming you. And, you know, I can't tell you how many squash blossom necklaces I have seen.
Oh, I can relate.
Maybe thousands.
I can relate.
And then all of a sudden, someone will bring you a squash blossom necklace with a hand-hammered naja with inlaid cut turquoise and ware that's 100 years old, and you go, oh my goodness, it's exciting.
It is exciting. It's fun to watch people react. It's not only fun for them, it's fun for you too, because you know in some cases you've changed their lives, and that's a wonderful
feeling,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we do, and I think sometimes people don't realize it as being an art dealer, is that we actually can change people's lives by being honest and ethical and saying, this is what you got, and this is the value, and whether they want to sell it or not. But it can be very important to their family, to their next generation as well.
Absolutely. Over and over again, folks will say, I don't really care what it's worth because I don't want to sell it. It's a family heirloom, but I need to know.
Right, they do need to know.
Or someone will say, gee, I really want to send my child to college, and this is going to help a lot.
I've done that before. I know of pieces I bought that went to college. I know pieces I bought that the people went into nursing homes and could afford it. I've had people that had to have chemotherapy, and the things that I sold went directly to chemotherapy. So, we do a service as well.
There's a responsibility.
Absolutely, there is.
You know, if I don't know a thing about... social media or the computers, I'm illiterate. So I'm in the hands of somebody who teach me. If someone comes in with a Native American object that was made 150 years ago and they have absolutely no experience with it, they need to be able to depend upon a professional to tell them the truth.
They need people like us out there. They need products online, you know, things like we do, our YouTube videos, just so people can go and learn. You know, I think it's important not only for them to know what they're doing, but we want the next generation of collectors to feel comfortable with what they're getting into and to maybe go, wow, this is something really great I want to do. I think, you know, having you on and hearing your story of your life and how you've donated your whole life to this, right? You love it. You clearly love it just as much as you did when you were a kid picking up those rocks.
I do. It's true.
And it's out there. I mean, this is wonderful material if you'll embrace it. You've embraced it for sure.
It's extraordinary.
And your kids, too. Your kids are both good art dealers and have great aesthetics, and I like them both very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And you've done an enormous service. You're an educator, And if anything's going to save us, it's the truth.
Yeah, the truth is important. And I've had Ted Trotta on today. He's fantastic. If you watch the Antiques Roadshow, you'll see Ted. And guess what? I always agree with your appraisals. They're right on the money. You're very good. You're very good. Thank you so much.
You're very kind.
For coming. All right. Ted Trotta, Art Dealer Diaries.